Welcome to Novelist Spotlight. This is Mike Consul, your host. In addition to being the host of this podcast and interviewing novelists, I am a novelist myself. I have three published novels. My latest is titled Lolita Firestone, a supernatural novel, and it is set in Sedona, Arizona and Cairo, Egypt. My previous novel is titled Family Recipes, a novel about Italian culture, Catholic guilt, and the culinary crime of the century. And my first novel is named Hardwood, a novel about college basketball and other games young men play. And that story deals with issues ranging from depression and racism to sex, religion, and university politics. All three novels are listed in the episode notes. I hope you will buy them, I hope you will read them, and I hope you will thoroughly enjoy them. Now, on with our program. In the spotlight is my guest, Carl von der Roe, an award-winning author of crime fiction. It's a profession he took a long time to get to because he had another profession before that as an international banker, but he long wanted to be a full-time author. He is today. He grew up in Cleveland, left Cleveland to study at Stanford University, spent more than 30 years in the banking business in the United States, Latin America, and North Africa. One can just imagine Carl von der Roe at a Casablanca bazaar, negotiating for a Moroccan rug or who knows what tapestry. An interesting life Carl has lived in those international settings and those bazaars that he's gone to. Those are sources of inspiration for his books. His first novel is called Murderabilia, which was published back in 2019, and it won the Left Coast Crime Award for Best Debut. Not a bad way to enter the book publishing business. And then it also won a San Diego Book Award for Best Mystery. And then his second novel, which came out in August 2023, this most recent August, is titled Saving Miles. Miles is spelled not the conventional way, but M-Y-L-E-S. Of course, this is all in the episode notes, so you can see that there. And again, that's his latest novel. In addition to his writing, some of the ancillary activities include being president of Partners in Crime, the San Diego chapter of Sisters in Crime, an organization that supports authors and fans of crime writing. So Carl von der Roe lives in beautiful San Diego. I was just down in San Diego for an investment conference. Mm-hmm. Beautiful San Diego. Actually, it was Carlsbad, which is contiguous to San Diego. And they have two grown sons. He lives in San Diego with his wife, two grown sons, none of them in the basement, no failure to launch there. Carl taught his sons properly. They're off and doing their thing. Carl, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
I appreciate you taking the time. Let me start with the a kind of baseline question. Why crime? You wanted to be a writer. And there's so many different genres that are available. You could have done romance, you could have done corporate espionage, you could have done sci-fi, or just general fiction, changing topics by whim. You obviously have something for crime. What is it about that genre or that subject matter?
I don't know. Some people think it's because I was a banker for so long, but you know.
I was going to ask you, did you see a lot of crime? Did you witness a lot of financial crime during your years as an international banker?
No, a few things that were really interesting, but not much, not much really. And, you know, I was in North Africa 3 months after the invasion of Iraq. So, you know, there were a lot of interesting things that were going on around me. And, you know, when you go to Latin America, there's always fear of crime on the streets. But, you know, I think what attracts me to crime is that it accentuates all the problems within relationships. And my moniker is that behind every crime is a family. So I'm very much character driven in my novels, in terms of what are the family problems that led to the crime, and how does the crime produce, you know, how do the family problems affect how the crime is experienced by other characters? So,
Well, tell us more about that. Why do you think that it boils down to a family? And we've heard of crime families, of course, the mafias, the crime families, but you're talking beyond something like that, it sounds like. What is
sure.
it about families? Go deeper on that one for us.
Well, when I begin to write a book, I look at the main characters, who are usually a family, and I look at their background, and there is something that has made this family dysfunctional in the past. And that dysfunctionality then gets really blown out of proportion when they're put under the pressure of having to deal with a crime. And so they have to reconcile with that past and all those problems they've had in order to solve the crime and, move on, have a character arc.
You remember Dog Day Afternoon, where Al Pacino's robbing a bank. He and his partner, who I believe they wanted the money for a sex change for his partner. It was very strange. But you also hear about people who commit crimes, and I don't know if it's an excuse or not, but they'll commit crime because they've got a sick wife, let's say, or a sick child, and they need the money for health care. And whether that's just a cover story, I'm sure in some cases it is the case, because we'll do anything for our loved ones when they're facing suffering and potential death. There's various motivations for crime. Now, did you grew up reading crime novels? Were you a crime fancier?
I read thrillers and some crime novels, but I read literary novels too. I read all kinds of stuff. I don't read fantasy. I don't read science fiction. I'm not in that area.
Was there a particular crime writer that was the most influential for you, or maybe a couple?
No, I don't think so. But Jean Le Carré, because of his voices, you could say he is kind of crime. Thomas Harris, Silence of the Lambs. I mean,
Oh, yeah.
that was a great book. And there's empathy in those books for the most screwed up characters, and family. One of my favorite books is Winter's Bone by Daniel Woodrell, and they made a movie out of it too. And there you've got a young girl who is on a hero's journey. She's, I think, 15 or 16 years old. Her father is a meth dealer, and he's been arrested. To get his bond, he's had to pledge everything they own, and then he disappears. Her mother is psychologically broken. She's got two young brothers who depend on her like she's their mother. And so you see how she is motivated really to get involved with crime because she has to save her family.
Yeah, like I was saying, all kinds of different motivations, and you just named two standout writers, Le Carré and Thomas Harris, and who I also understand there are people who I saw the movie. I didn't read the novel, but he also wrote one, I think, called, what was it called, Dragonfly or something, that people said was even better than Silence of the Lambs. Of course, that's a subjective opinion.
I haven't read that one.
Okay, I may have the title wrong. You know, you wanted to be a writer for a long time, but you went to get your economics degree, and but after you got your economics degree, interestingly, you studied music for years, my understanding. Is that right?
I
Where did you
did.
study music?
At San Jose State University.
And what
So,
did you study? Were you studying composition, or what kind of, are you a vocalist? Are you an instrumentalist?
I was a classical guitar player, but I was kind of a folk singer, and I would write songs and do retunings on the guitar. I thought I was going to be the next Paul Simon, but I wasn't even the next Art Garfunkel.
You know, it was a good attempt. It was a good attempt, but what that tells me is that you really are your leanings are towards art, or you're artistic, but you went
They were.
into a much more, cold and calculated profession, banking. Nothing wrong with banking. I mean, one of the reasons I was interested in your bio, Carl, is I'm editor of Real Assets Advisor magazine, as I think you saw, and we write about private equity and venture capital and banking and all kinds of real estate and infrastructure, you name it. And
It can be, especially nowadays with fintech and everything, it can be a really
Yeah.
interesting industry, but it wasn't feeding your soul. It sounds like that, what you were really aiming to do was to get to the writing, to get to the music, to get to the writing, to get to the art. But before we talk a little bit more about that, you was banking kind of happenstance, or did you study economics with the intent of going into banking, or is that kind of that's the job I got and I actually excelled at it? So, I built a career there.
Yeah, no, it was, I thought it was the most practical thing I could do, an economics degree. I don't know. But so that's what I did. And I studied a lot of political science because I was very interested in international business. And I studied for a year in Colombia and studied some Portuguese. So banking was the sector I could enter in most quickly and do international work. So that's why I chose it. And then I just got into various different areas of banking.
Now,
I
you did
worked a lot.
international banking. So,
Yeah.
what define international banking? What does that really mean? And the reason I want to understand it a little bit better is because this influences your writing.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to travel. I wanted to work in other languages. So that's part of it, to go to other countries and have cu customers that are in other countries. But it also deals with things even that were in the US and in Canada where I worked. Like international trade. So I would finance imports and exports and do that as well. With correspondent banks, these are banks who are your customers in other countries. You're providing US or Canadian services to them. So that's kind of, I'm sort of
And the U.S.
describing
banking system
some.
is trusted. There's legal
Yes.
redress.
Yeah.
The dollar is preeminent,
Right.
at least for now. Some people
Yeah.
think China's going to become the reserve currency, but that appears to be a long ways off, especially now that China's
Right.
having so many problems. And there's
Yeah.
issues with being a reserve currency. It limits some of the things you can do, and that China's been doing over the years that. That they may not want to give up, like manipulation of their currency
Yeah,
and so on.
makes imports cheaper.
Yes, there you go. There you go. They're not the only country to play fast and loose that way,
There's their exports. Yeah, yeah,
there you go.
yeah,
So
yeah.
as you're banking, your years as a banker, were you writing fiction that whole time?
Not the whole time. So, I wanted to be a songwriter. And when I first went into banking, I was playing classical guitar still and trying to write things. And, I'd spend an hour or two a day on that. But I finally got to a level that I just decided I wanted to try something else. So it was right before my children were born, I took a class in writing. And, I used to make up stories when I was a kid and ghost stories. And so I decided I'd go back to it. And that's where I started to learn some of the craft in writing. So, this was a long time ago.
Yeah, how old were you roughly? I mean, were you in your late 20s, your 30s, your 40s?
I was about 30 when that happened.
So
Yeah.
you were writing songs too, or
Yeah.
putting lyrics to paper. Do you think you would have become a Paul Simon if you had found a tall, curly-haired guy to stand next to you? An Art Garfunkel
I
body
don't think,
double?
yeah, I don't think so. My songs were a little bit too strange.
Maybe Lou
And
Reed, maybe more a Lou
yeah,
Reed than a Paul
well,
Simon.
harmonically, they were a little too strange. I didn't. It's funny because I'd talk to other writers and they'd love the music, and then I'd talk to musicians and they'd love the lyrics, so that had to tell you something. So I don't have the kind of personality to be a big performance artist.
You'd be more a
So
songwriter, more a Paul Williams type. Than a
yeah,
performer.
right,
Yeah.
yeah,
So.
and not the voice, and there were things that held me back as a classical guitarist from technique. I didn't have the kind of ear to be a really great composer. So you realize these things when you do them. But then what I realize is to get good in something else, you have to give up something. So
Yeah. We
I
only have
gave
so
it up.
much, I remember an artist who I had, it was one of those outdoor fairs, and he became very famous. He wasn't that famous at the time, but In fact, his name is was Frogman. He'd do these iron frogs that were just beautifully painted, and I actually own one or two of them. And he my wife said, "Well, I'm an artist too." And he said, "What do you do?" And she go, "Well, I do this, I do that, I do something else." And he says, "You're gonna go nuts." And he says, "What you need to do is you focus on one thing and it will expand." And I think that that's one of the things that people sometimes the mistakes people sometimes make. If you don't, if you can find something singular, it will expand. It will grow because you start to just pull in information. It just seems to happen. It's almost like magic. And I've been, you know, I remember I visited with a writing instructor who called writing, excuse me, called writing an act of faith. Writing's hard. You sit down and you start to write, and it's a mess. And you have to continue to chisel away at it. And the magic happens if you're willing to stick with it. So you go to this writing class. Tell us about what did you learn in that writing class? I mean, did that get you off to a start?
It did. It did. And I was far from the star of the class. But, it taught me a few things like voice. It taught me how to use my own past and background. I was raised a Christian scientist, the religion that thinks you can heal illness. So it taught me how to use some of that background. One of the first things, it was with Molly Ramanujan in Chicago. One of the first things she taught us was the use of objects, which is kind of amazing at the beginning introductory level class that, objects can have a positive emotion to them, attached to them, a negative emotion attached to them, but the best objects that you use in writing have both of them attached to it. And so, as I write, I try to find objects that will evoke the character. So I learned some of those things. And I learned that, I just had to keep writing because the most important skill I have is tenacity.
Tenacity, yeah, that's certainly needed in fiction writing for sure. Probably any kind of writing, but fiction writing for sure. Tell us more about voice. He talked to you about voice. Do you have a voice,
I'm
Carl,
not.
in terms of like, for instance, readers of your first and second novel, now you're no doubt working on your third one. If they were to open it without seeing the author's name and start reading, would they sense that this is Carl Bondra's voice?
I'm not sure they would. My first novel was in first person. There was somewhat of a voice there. I wouldn't call it a one of a kind voice. But there was definitely a voice there. And the second novel has been in third person, where you do have a voice as well. But the voice was more in terms of who those characters were. And then my third novel I'm doing in third person, but it's all within the perspective of close third person.
So what did she say about voice? What did she teach the class about voice?
Boy, it's been so long ago, I can't remember. But she, it's your particular way of phrasing things, your particular background that you bring to the story. Your particular insights and opinions about things. I think that's all of the voice. And we'd read things out loud and you could hear the voice right away in some people, just because that's where they came from.
So there was this something distinctive about the voice, and it would have to do, like, for instance, Southern writers tend to sound different than somebody who grew up in Minneapolis or what have you. You know,
Well,
that's interesting.
and I can't sound like a black writer, an African American writer. I just
Right,
can't.
right.
I can maybe sound like a Latin American writer by the way they use their English. But still.
And you're Spanish speaking, right? You speak Spanish and some Portuguese?
I've done business in Spanish and French and some in Portuguese. My Portuguese is the worst of the three.
Not too
But,
much Brazilian banking.
well, I never got to travel to Brazil that much,
Oh,
unfortunately.
okay. What about
Yeah.
objects? I find that very interesting that she talked about objects and she's saying that objects have a certain character. And it sounds like what she was saying to you and you're conveying is that you can use an object to kind of nail a situation or a character to add content to that character or that situation. Is that roughly what she was talking about?
Yeah, because they evoke who that character is and where they came from and what's important and what that character fears. I mean, all these, plus a mystery about the character. Some things you can't quite put your finger on why they have that object, but it tells you something about them. Have you ever read the book Things They Carry by Tim O'Brien, The Things They Carry?
Yeah, so what about Vietnam?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's like a primer on the use of objects.
That's a great point. That's a
Yeah.
great point. That book, because yeah, it had to do with that people carrying something that was precious to them, as I
Yeah.
recall. There they are, putting their lives at risk. They're likely going to die, and they wanted something that was like a talisman or just something precious that a girlfriend or wife had given them.
Yeah, I mean, th there's one guy, his girlfriend sent him a stone from the beach. And, you know, he carries this stone and it symbolizes the beach and who they were. And maybe it's a separation of the shore and the beach that his girlfriend is feeling about him. And then there's one point where he's marching and he puts the stone in his mouth. I mean, it's just, you know, you go, wow.
Yeah, that was an amazing book. I'm glad you brought that up. I read it, God, probably 5, 6 years ago, and now I've got a little distance from it, but that's great that you bring that back up. It was a great idea. And I believe it was a decorated book. I'm not sure if it won a Pulitzer or what, but I
Don't
think it
know.
was certainly well regarded and is repeated to this day as a as one of the great books of Vietnam and just great novels.
Yeah.
So here you are at the bank. You want to
Yeah.
write fiction. You take a writing class. How far along were you when you just started writing fiction in earnest? You didn't retire from banking before you started
No,
writing. You
no.
wrote during your career. Talk a little bit about when you really got started with it.
Well, first of all, I didn't tell anyone at the bank that I was secretly a writer, because I didn't think it would reflect well for my career, because they wanted people that were totally dedicated to what they were
Exactly.
doing in banking. So,
Carl's getting
and
distracted, they would say. He's getting distracted. I'm not sure he's the guy for this assignment. Maybe he doesn't get the promotion.
yeah, I remember one. I mean, I worked at the Northern Trust, and one guy said, "Oh, you studied guitar for a year? What were you, a rock star at the night?" I mean, that was a pretty flirt, you know, that was a pretty dumb thing to do. You know, I thought, okay, well, we won't talk about that. And then I w interviewed with a bank here in San Diego, and he said, "Well, what do you like to do?" Well, I kind of edge up to it. And I say, "Well, I'd like to read books at night." And he thought I was a tree hugger because I like to read books at night, you know, and fiction books. And so I
It's
kept
amazing the
that.
impressions people get, these false impressions about, they're maybe they want somebody who's one-dimensional, but I'd never think that you're as effective as a one-dimensional person than a multidimensional person, because you always
No.
draw, you extrapolate from, I mean, the creativity that you use in writing, I'm sure you used in your work and negotiating and the way
Sure.
just the emotional intelligence that you displayed when working with people.
Sure. I mean, and there are these wonderful characters that you meet in banking and you use them in your books. And, you know, and there's this idea of thinking not linearly, but horizontally that you have to do in writing that, you know, that helps you think of new solutions to things in your banking. And you're a better writer when you write letters to clients or you write credit write-ups because of all that training. So, you know, I never told people that, but I think some of them suspected it. But you know, hey, it's you know, when you're in the closet, it's better that people suspect it rather than coming out and declaring it,
Right.
you
Have some
know.
deniability.
Yeah.
So how old were you when you really started writing fiction? Were you in your 40s by that
30s.
point? In your 30s. Okay.
Yeah.
So how did talk about the progression? You didn't start publishing books while you were a banker. It wasn't until later. So what was the progression like? How many false starts? And did you start off trying to write a novel right away, or did you just decide,
No.
I'm going to play with some fiction writing, just play with it, or maybe do some short stories? How did you handle it?
I tried to do some short stories and scenes, and I drew a lot from, growing up as a Christian Scientist, and tried to do that, never published anything. Then I decided, maybe the way I can mix it all this together is crime writing. So I started writing a crime novel while we were still living in Chicago with my two very young sons. And then I continued that when we moved to Montreal. And it was just a matter of, any chance I got. If I had 15 minutes, I would write. If, sometimes I'd go out to lunch at the bank and I'd just write. Or if I had a half an hour between when I finished at the bank and when the bus came or, the subway came, I'd write just in any increment I could find because, I had a family and I had two young kids. So I had to balance all of that together. And my job was 50, 60 hours a week. So,
So along the way, did you attend writers' conferences? Is that part of what you did?
I think I really got much better when I moved to San Diego and there were writers' conferences and critique groups and feedback I could get here because I just didn't have it in Montreal. There's a fair amount of English spoken, but it's a French-speaking city and I only knew a few writers and none of the resources that I could get in San Diego. So there I started to really learn more about writing. And then, I got this idea for Murderabilia. I wanted it to be, I wanted it to bring in Christian Science. I wanted it to bring in private banking, and I wanted it to bring in photography. So I thought, what would be a secret that a private banker for the very wealthy, which was what I was doing, wouldn't tell anyone? And that was, well, suppose his father was a serial killer, a very famous serial killer, and that the family had changed the name and moved and nobody knew it. And then I thought, well, I was a Christian Scientist, and Christian Scientists believe that evil is a false concept, and if you don't give it any power, it will cease to exist. And I thought, wow, what a perfect religion for the wife of a serial killer. So I put all of that in it. And then, he had to do something that made him distinctive. And suppose he, photographed his victims, but they were so well composed that he was famous, his father. And then how do you escape the stigma from all of that? So, these things just kind of. The
And
what
that's when the
if
name change came along,
the murder would be, yeah,
but
right.
then so the son was the very wealthy. You were basically a private banker for this for the son of the or the character was for the son of the murderer, who was imprisoned by that point, or was he dead?
He was in prison, but the son hadn't seen him for over 30 years. And the son is a private bank for all these wealthy people, which there are a fair amount of in San Diego and in LA, as you know. So he keeps that secret, but then the plot, the inciting incident is that suppose this private banker is accused of the same crime his father was, and everybody thinks he did it, and the father is the only one that can help him solve the crime. So,
That's novel number one. So novel number
yeah.
two, August 2023, Saving Miles is published. Give us the summary on Saving Miles without any without any spoilers.
Sure. Well, and that went through an interesting kind of progression, but I'll talk about the premise first. It's two parents who have had a very difficult time raising their troubled teenage son. And it's been so difficult, they had to send him to a residential treatment center. When the son comes back, he seems to be totally changed. He's got a new outlook on life, he's getting straight A's at school. But all the difficulties of raising this son have blown this marriage apart, and the two parents are living separately. Then the son sneaks off to Mexico, tries to do a drug deal, and gets kidnapped. The only way these parents can save their son a second time is to become involved in money laundering and to reconcile as a couple and as a family.
The money is laundered through
Through
what?
a bank.
Through
Through a
a bank.
bank.
They're do okay. They're not buying real estate and making it look legit. They're just going through it, maybe like a Russian oligarchs did with Deutsche Bank. Deutsche Bank, I believe, I mean, check me on this, but it has been fined billions of dollars over the years
Billions.
for money. I mean, they were not paying it. They knew what they were doing. They were laundering
Oh,
money.
they knew. They knew.
And, you know, this was the last bank that would do business with Donald Trump. And this is part of the story the media never seems to tell, is that all this Russian money coming that's funneled through that bank. And then you've got, it's the last bank that would work with Donald Trump. And then the Russian oligarchs were buying a bunch of apartments and condominiums from the Trump organization. So there was a major connection there. So, and I don't belong to the Republican or Democratic Party. Let me just say that I never have belonged, never will belong. So I don't want to make it political, but these kind of connections, this is all very interesting in real life and in fiction. And your fiction is not tied to the Trump organization anyway, but the idea is that you write fiction that's based on reality, things that really have or could happen. So I don't really believe there's any, you know, short of fantasy is probably nothing like that's actually fiction. It's always grounded in some kind of reality. You know, one of the interesting things that I heard you say, Carl, when I was doing some background research on you, is that your first, well, actually, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. You hired a developmental editor, is my understanding. Is that right? Why did you hire an editor? What state was you writing in at that time that you thought, I need some help with this?
So I had a draft of Murderabilia at that point, but I wasn't sure it really worked. And I had excellent scenes, but how about the overall architecture of the book? So I went to a writers' conference and we, did these presentations and I gave the premise of my book and everybody loved the premise. And a woman then said, I asked her, it was Jacqueline Michard who wrote Deep End of the Ocean. And I asked her, do you know someone I could use as a developmental editor? Someone could help me to make sure the book works? She said, yeah, I think I do. Me. So, wow. I thought, first Oprah selection was her book. And what had happened is she'd lost all her money in a financial scam. And so she was doing editing to make ends meet. And so she was
Wow.
taking on writers like me, beginning writers. So I learned a lot from her. And that got that book published. And even now, my third book, I submitted it to a developmental editor because I just want to make sure, it works from a big picture standpoint.
Well, this was a home run then, huh? I mean, what kind of evolution did the book go through with your developmental editor? How much did it change?
Oh, it was an odyssey. It changed somewhat. She helped me bring in backstory more for it. She helped me from start some of the stylistic elements. She helped me with the ending. I worked with her for 2 years, and then she then she recommended me to her agent, and the agent, I did. He kind of held on to it for a year. He'd give me feedback on revisions every 3 months, his young reviewers. And then he decided, maybe I'm not the agent for you. So then I had to go out and find another agent, which I did, and
What?
did.
Why did she say I'm not? Maybe I'm not the agent for you. She tried. It couldn't get it sold, and just decided I gave it my best. Maybe somebody else has a source.
Never submitted it. He thought that the voice wasn't strong enough, and he thought, I don't know, I guess he just thought, well, here's the thing. He had a very good book at the time, it was also about the child of a serial killer called The Marsh King's Daughter. So I'm sure he was comparing it to that. And he just didn't think it was the kind of book he could represent. So, there were things I had to learn. I did more revisions on the book and fixed a few things, and so it eventually, with my other agent, got sold and won some prizes. So,
So you ended up finding another agent, and that
Yeah.
agent is the same agent you're with to this day. Is that
I
right?
am. I am. And I got her through a one sentence pitch.
What was the sentence?
Yeah, well, let me tell you the background first.
Sure.
So I thought, one of the hardest things authors have to do and they can't do is to boil down their book to a single paragraph and then a single elevator sentence. But that's what agents and publishers need because they got to be able to represent this book to booksellers very quickly. And so I went to a conference called the Algonquian Writers Conference in New York to learn how to do that. Spent 3 days in New York and I thought, wow, this was a lot of money to learn how to do that. But okay. And then I went to a writers conference in San Francisco and we're in one of these networking sessions, and you've probably been to writers' conferences, but there'll be editors there'll be agents there, and all these wannabe writers like me, and we're all just hoping that somebody will ask us about our book, please. So you kind of sidle up to people and hope they'll ask you a question, and they're this editor and this agent were talking, gossiping about the industry, and then this agent turns to me and she says, "Okay, describe your book in one sentence." And I had it. So the sentence was, a banker for the very wealthy has his life torn apart when he's accused of being a serial killer like his father. So, the last thing made them all go, ooh, and that's like a trophy for a writer, right?
Yeah. Oh,
You'll
absolutely.
remember that forever.
It's so difficult to get somebody's attention with a book or a pitch because there's
Yeah.
just so many people out there.
Yeah.
And this gets back to your writing advice to people, which is patience and tenacity that you have to be. It's not just about being a good writer. You can be a great writer, but if you don't have the stick-to-itiveness, then you're not going to end up published unless you just do
Right.
it yourself, which a lot
Yeah.
of people do, which is why
A
the
lot of
market
people
is so
do.
flooded with books and has made it harder to get attention.
Yeah.
So it's just in your character. You wanted this, so it's in your character to be tenacious about it and be patient.
Yeah.
But you got some big breaks there.
I
That
did.
was, I think that first agent probably did you a service by saying, I'm not the right guy for you.
Right.
And then
Right.
here's the second, your current agent was obviously
A much
worked
better
for
fit.
you. It
Yeah,
worked
much.
out.
Yeah. I mean, and then, it's a lot of disasters, but disasters kind of point the way, I mean, the other thing that happened was, all right, we sent it out to all these publishers, all these acquisition editors, and most of them didn't want it. And finally, Midnight Inc. Supported it. So yeah, we want this book, and they had a lot of good authors. 3 months after we signed the contract, their parents said, "Well, we're closing our doors." So. The publisher's going out of business.
Wow, then what happened?
Well, they said, "We're going to support all the people that we've signed contracts with, and we're going to give you all kinds of support." Well, not really, but do I want to spend another year, pitching this book? I want to move on to something else. So we stuck with them, and they published the book, and then it got nominated for Left Coast Crime. And the conference was in San Diego, and I thought, wow, this is great. This is where I live. I'll have lots of people I know there. I can really sell the book at the conference. One day after the conference started, because of COVID, it was canceled.
Wow.
So
Wow.
you think, is
So you
anything
got
going to
one
go
day of the
right?
conference in, and then it got canceled after that. They said no more. Jeez.
They were ordered to close it down by the city. Because of COVID. It was just the beginning of COVID, in early 2020. So I thought, oh my God, is anything going to go right about this? But it had been nominated for Best Debut, and there was a vote for Best Debut, and it won. So who am I to complain? You're right?
Right. Yeah. So you were raised a Christian Scientist, you say. Talk
Yeah.
What was it like being raised a Christian Scientist? Were your parents devout? Were you devout as a young man? Are you still a Christian Scientist?
No, but it's a contradiction because, if you're if God is perfect and all you have to do is reflect God and you will be perfect and that will sort of heal all illness and all psychological issues you have, that's one thing. But doing it day to day, you get sick. Does that mean you don't go to a doctor? Well, my parents weren't like that. They said, you get sick, you go to a doctor. But Carl, here's something. I know you're only 6 years old, but when you go to Sunday school, don't tell anyone that you went to a doctor.
Oh, yeah. They
So you
wanted to keep
make
that private. Yep.
keep it private. And and my aunt, who was a devout Christian Scientist, my great aunt actually, just one day she disappeared. And her husband came over and told my parents that I was about 8 or 9 at this point, that she was ill and she was going to heal it herself and she wanted to stay in her condo so that she could keep her thoughts pure and purely reflect God and not have anything polluted with, other thoughts from other people. So we weren't even allowed to see her. And she died by herself with her husband in that condo, probably from cancer, probably a great pain.
Wow.
So these kinds of contradictions. And yet, there's something to be said for seeing people as it's the problem when you hate somebody is not that that person, it's the way you perceive them. There's something very empowering about that. And also, it was a religion founded by a woman in the late 1800s. And when did that happen? And my father said, okay, so you're in the early 1900s, you get sick. Are you better to try and heal yourself or go to a hospital? So, something to be said about that because hospitals were just, petri dishes.
Right. And there are people today that, who use healthcare, but when they come down with a deadly illness, they sometimes just say, that's nature's going to take its course. I'm not going to go through the paces of chemo or radiation or whatever it might be. It's kind of God's will. I'm going to die eventually anyway, and let nature take its course. Yeah, I mean, there are people who kind of think that are not Christian Scientists who kind of think along the lines of sometimes nature has spoken and you just let it go. Although the idea with Christian Scientists is that that kind of faith in God will heal you is part of
But it's
the.
up to you to reflect it correctly and get
Yeah.
all the false conceptions about evil out of your mind. So there's a personal responsibility to it and a personal guilt because it's your own damn fault if you're
Yeah,
sick.
that's the negative side is that you blame the sick person for being sick. I mean, that can happen, and it does outside of Christian Scientists as well, Christian Science. It comes. I mean, there are people who, it's kind of like you're not a positive enough thinker. You're not living the right life. You eat a bad diet. It's your fault. You're sick. Pretty sad.
Well, and here's the two famous people that were Christian Scientists were Haldeman and Ehrlichman in the Nixon
Well,
administration.
I didn't even know that.
I went to school. Ehrlichman's two sons were at Stanford at the same time I was, and one was a freshman with me, and his father was just hated by all the other students, and he had to live through that,
Wow. Yeah, there you go. That's almost the, serial dad's a serial killer. Not that they, not that Ehrlichman or Haldeman were, but dad's a serial killer and I'm getting tarred with it. Dad is a Watergate, one of the Watergate crew. Here I am being hated because of him.
And here are all the evil things they did, and how did they rationalize that as Christian Scientists?
Exactly.
And those kinds of contradictions really interest me as a novel writer.
Yeah. Well, and that's yeah, absolutely. That's what really gives a story its force in many cases. Now that you're a full-time writer, Carl, what is your writing regimen like? Are you a morning writer or an evening writer? Are you still chiseling out 15-minute increments, 15 times a day?
Sometimes, but I I mean, I write 7 days a week and sometimes more than at other times, but the writing has gotten a lot of the marketing is taken over from the writing time, which is just the way it is now. But I start early in the morning. I'm usually at my desk or at a coffee house by about 7:30 or 7:15, and then I'll work and I'll take breaks, come home for lunch, work in the afternoon. Then I stop at 6 or 7, and spend the evening with my wife. I work out three times a week, so I'll do that at night as well, for the most part. So that's the kind of regimen. Am
So
I
you like
writing?
coffee? You eat right at home, or you might go to a coffee house because you want some
Yeah,
activity around you and a little
I
bit of.
do. And lack of distraction. I don't want to be able to turn on the TV to, to MSNBC or CNN,
And
you
hear
get
about hear
sucked
about
into it.
tragedy.
Oh yeah.
So do you write on paper? Do you write with a laptop? What do you do?
That's a good question. I found that when I do the first draft, usually of scenes, I write on paper, because I find it more freeing. And I'm writing as fast as I can. And when you're really caught up in the writing process, you can't keep up with the story. You're writing so fast. So that knocks the editor out of me. And there'll be gaps, that I'll have to fill in later. And sometimes it'll only be dialogue, but so what? I need a point of view. Lots of things I need to fill in, but I just get it down as fast as I can. Then I'm when I'm 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pages, I'll realize, well, I've got a scene here, and there's something, there's a relief that it works, right? And I let my mind go where the scene goes. I kind of have an idea what the conflict is, maybe the ending, but sometimes the ending of the scene changes as we go through. And so that's kind of a first dab at the creative process. Then I try to type it into my computer within 24 hours, fill in some of the gaps. And that's the way I do the first draft on scenes. I do have an outline, but and Murderabilia was very detailed. I had a 60-page outline. And Saving Miles not so d is detailed, but I have an idea of what the scenes are, what the characters are, where the scenes will fit in, and I do that. But then it changes.
Why less detailed with Saving Miles? Is it because you were more experienced and you felt like you had a little more command?
That was part of it. And plus, I just hate outlining.
Yeah, I understand.
You have to figure out the backstory and what are the motivations of the characters, what are their fears, and what are their values, and what do they want to accomplish in life? What's the third rail going on underneath them? And what's the how does it relate to the premise? And you got to do kind of all that hard work before you start to write. And then, of course, it changes as you write. And the ending, I always have an idea for the ending, and it always changes. So.
Now, when you come up with an idea for a novel, a premise,
Yeah.
do you just start writing, hacking away at that to figure out whether it's got momentum? Have you come up with ideas where you started working on the novel and then decided, this doesn't feel right, or I don't feel any sense of momentum or cohesiveness, and you drop it and come up with a different idea? Or have you been able to see your concept through to finish in each of these cases?
I have given up on a few things. I usually come up with a premise and some idea of the outline, then I'll start writing. And for instance, I tried to do a sequel to Murderabilia. I must have written 15,000-20,000 words, and just didn't work. So, okay, I set
When
it
you say didn't
aside.
work, though, explain, did you lose interest in it? Did you not feel a lot of energy for it, or was the writing flat? What made you say this isn't working?
I thought it wasn't developing enough new ground, and I was a little bored with the characters. I thought that it was a little bit unbelievable, and I wanted to explore something different. I wanted different conflicts. And I didn't want to just continue with the same characters. So.
Understandable. So you would not be the kind of crime writer who has the same characters through throughout like Robert Marlowe or Spencer or something like that. You want new
No.
characters because you don't want to just keep rehashing the character.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a young man. So, you got to grab these opportunities while you still can and grab new, not only new characters, but new ideas, right? So, I'm in Murderabilia, I had to learn all about photography. So that was interesting. In Saving Miles, I had to learn all about money laundering. So that was interesting. And I one of the bankers there, at one point I called him the Jungian banker. Then I decided, no, you got to have dreams, and I'm not going to have dreams in this novel. But he's kind of a new age philosophy guy. So I learned all about alchemy, which is a perfect metaphor for money laundering. And, and how that philosophy related to this man's philosophy. So, that if I'd written a series, would I have been able to do that? I don't think so.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
So novel number three, do you have a title for it yet?
I
And are you
do.
sharing
I
it?
no, I'll share it as it is right now. It's still in the banking industry. It's called Past Due so far.
Dreaded words for anybody past due. And then tell us, can you tell us a little bit about it, or are you keeping that close
I'll
to the
tell you a
vest?
little bit, but I mean, some of the stylistic things I tried to do, I'm going to keep to myself because I think they're kind of interesting. Until I get a publisher. My novels so far have taken place in the banking industry. And one was the private banking, and Saving Miles was the high-end commercial real estate sector. And this one is just in a retail branch of a bank. And you've got a banker who has lost his wife, and he's been grieving that forever. He's kind of attracted to his colleague who is the superstar in the branch. And then she dies suddenly from a seeming drug overdose, and he knows she never took drugs. So his job now, and kind of to resuscitate his life, is to find out why.
Wow. So you're doing some research on drug overdoses.
Yeah, I did. I did. Yeah. And grieving.
And
I had to
grieving,
look.
yes.
Yeah, I've read a lot about grieving and, how people, how they manifest it and how it crops up in unexpected places and how they never get over it and they learn to live with it. And then how do you fall in love with another person after you've lost the one you've been with for more than 20 years?
So you've given us some real understanding about what motivates you as a writer, Carl. What motivates you generally, just as a person, setting writing aside?
I'm curious. I like creativity. I love humor, which is kind of it's like a writing process. It's humorous surprise, but yet it's all set up. I like nonprofits. I work with a group called Social Venture Partners, and we mentor no other nonprofits, for board development and strategic planning and fundraising and that kind of thing. And I worked a lot with the YMCA as well. So that motivates me as well. I like family and movies, and you just run out of time. There are things I'd like to do, and I just don't have time for them.
Well, you work out a few times a week, you said. What's your exercise of choice?
So I do it's pretty much the same thing, but I will do initially some workout with machines and sit-ups and my core and that so forth, and that's typically 20 minutes to a half an hour, and then I'll do a spin class, which is really hard for the cardiovascular side, and then I'll do some stretching.
Oh, there you go. So you're kind of covering your bases, be it strength training, aerobic training, and then also stretching, keeping the joints limber, and so
Trying to,
on.
yeah.
What do you see as your greatest strength as a writer? There's so many different aspects to fiction writing, there's the pacing, there's
Yeah.
characterization, there's
Yeah.
dialogue, there's
Yeah.
description. You had that instructor who talked about objects, which oftentimes involves description, their sense of place. What do you feel is your greatest strength?
I'm not sure, but I think because I've worked on all these things, right? So I think I'm pretty good at character now. I've always, I guess, been pretty good at dialogue because I'm a fairly auditory person, and I've learned languages, and so I pick up on that. I'm not overly visual. It's funny because my mother and my sister were both watercolor painters, but I got a different part of the brain. So I worked very hard on that to bring that visual element in it, and settings as well. I think I'm strong on settings because I will go to a place and I'll just try and absorb it in order to get that setting right.
I think that's a really powerful aspect of writing, because if you can get the setting right, the reader is in the environment,
Yes.
which is critical, because once they're if you can draw them into the environment and they feel a sense of place as they read, that's pretty sticky. It's pretty
Yeah.
sticky. I think you keep a reader around that way. I know obviously there's other components that have to work as well, but yeah, that sense of place. I remember this woman who had read, well, she's a reviewer with the New York Times, and I heard her on a podcast talk about Philip Roth's book American Pastoral, and she said, I'll never forget it, she said, from the minute I started reading that, like that first paragraph, I was in that world. I was
Yeah.
totally within that novel
Yeah.
and in that world, which is a about as high a praise as you can get. I mean,
Oh,
obviously
yeah.
Philip Roth was a superstar.
And how did he learn about all about glove making, you know?
Exactly. The
Yeah.
yeah, the, I mean, it was a tour de force. It was a tour de force. It
Yeah.
won a Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
I loved American The Human Stain as well, which I
Oh,
believe came
yeah.
right before or after. In fact, that's probably my favorite of all of his novels, as The Human Stain. It was even a good movie, even though, yeah, I don't know, you read The Human Stain and you think you'd be nuts to try to make a movie after this book, but they actually pulled it off pretty well. So
Yeah.
that was Ed Harris and Nicole Kidman and Gary
Ah.
Sinise.
Well, they had some pretty good actors.
Yes, he did definitely drew some good actors in. Are there any rituals that you tie to your writing each day? Anything that you do to prepare, Carl, or is it more like just reporting to work? You
I
grab the
hate to
lunch
say
bucket.
it. That's the banker in me. I report for duty,
Well, that's what it takes, though, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To be successful, you have to treat it as a job. If you're just a dilettante, and
Yeah.
if I feel it, I write. If I don't, I don't. Well, that's a
Yeah.
formula for not getting a lot done, in many
Yeah.
cases, unless the person's
Yeah.
always feeling
Can I
inspired.
go back to setting? Because
Yeah, please.
I think there's something really important about setting because it forces a character to act. And the way the character interprets the setting has to do with point of view, and it adds an emotional content to the setting. So if when you can get all those elements into a setting, it becomes an interacting character.
Gotcha. I just took a note on that one.
I mean, you can say the house had windows on the front. It had a slate roof. It had a door in the front. It's like, so what? But you could say, his house was the ugliest and the most beautiful house he'd ever seen. Right there, you've got an emotion connected to the setting, and you've got the description follows, to illustrate that.
Yes. So just back, you don't observe rituals. Do you ever use any stimulants or acceler? I've gotten in the habit of asking
Yeah.
authors if they anything from hitting caffeine to smoking dope to doing breathing exercises to try to create an
Yeah.
altered state of consciousness. Are there any crimes committed by Carl Vondero in your crime writing? Actually, it's not a crime in California, but cannabis is legal.
I just want to say that I was acquitted, okay?
And you've changed your name so that to protect the innocent.
And Dad had his hobbies, so what?
Tell us what a good day of writing is to you. I don't know if you do any targeting, if you do any targeting in terms of word count or page count, whether it's qualitative or quantitative, but
Well,
if
my
when
method
what's a good
is,
day of writing to you?
yeah, my good day is a few pages, but and sometimes it's just getting through the book and revising, like what I'm doing now. It's changing all the time. I did NaNoWriMo for that's what is it, National? I don't
The
know.
national, this is where you write a few thousand words a day. You're supposed to
Yeah.
write 40,000 in the course of 30 or 40,000 in the course of a month,
50, yeah.
50,000. The
Yeah.
idea being that just get it written, don't let the
Yeah.
editor get in the way,
Yeah.
and be productive. And I think the idea, you check me on this, Carl, but I think the
Yeah.
idea is when you allow yourself to just write, you will find a level of productivity, but also a level of creativity. You by getting out of your own way, the subconscious mind tends to kick into gear, and you can maybe do some of your best writing in those circumstances.
Yeah. I mean, that's the idea.
Did you hit the target when you did that?
Yeah, I did. I did, and it was for the book I'm working on now, although it's 2 years later.
Wow.
But I hit 50,000, and a lot of it was bad writing, and a lot of the book got changed. But you got 50,000 words,
And you could always throw
so
the verbiage. Yeah, that's the thing is
yeah.
you throw out you any writer has to throw out a lot of copy. You know, I
Yeah.
mean, I sometimes wonder what percentage of copy actually makes the cut.
Yeah.
You know,
Yeah.
there's a lot of writers who I think would say, 90% of what I write, because I give myself the freedom to cut loose, I throw it away. But that 10% shines because I allow myself to cut loose.
Right. Well, and the interesting thing about my first writing coach in Chicago, she said, "Okay, I want you to write about this, and you got 10 minutes, and that's it." And she had a timer. It forced you to do the same thing. Just get out of your way and write, and see what you have. So NaNoWriMo did that for me. First time I've done it, I didn't do it. I haven't done it since. But will I do it the next book? I don't know. It's in November. I want to start before then. But I might do something before then.
So
So,
50,000, how many is it a month? Is
yeah,
not
it's a month,
okay. That's right, because it's
November.
called National. It's a writing month. That I forget what the acronym or the shorthand stands for, but yeah, 50,000 words in a month. So I have to ask you this question, Carl, because you are a musician.
Yeah.
If your style of writing was represented by a musical or genre, what would it be? Would it be Paul, Simon and Garfunkel, or would it be something different?
I hadn't thought about that. It might be.
So it might be folk music.
Yeah, because it's commercial. It's not, overly literary. I mean, we all try to be literary, right? We all try to be great writers and write beautiful sentences. But it's got a commercial audience. And so, that's kind of like Simon and Garfunkel, where they were poems set to music, and but poems for the common people.
Tell us something people would be surprised to do. I mean, you've revealed a lot of yourself already, Carl, so it may be out of the
Yeah.
bag, but is there something that people would be surprised to know about you?
I don't know. No, a lot of people didn't know that I was a guitarist and a musician. They didn't know I was a Christian Scientist when I grew up. And that's all I can legally tell you.
Tell us about the turning, maybe it's not a turning point, but tell us when you knew that I'm going to be okay with this. I'm good at this, and I'm going to do well with this. Was there a point at which you realized I'm not just putting words on paper? I'm actually assembling real storytelling here, and I'm going to
Yeah.
be successful at it.
I think it was during my first book, Murderabilia, and I was already in San Diego at that time. And well, no, I take that back. I take that back because I wrote a book that was never published that took place in Colombia, and I wrote a lot of that book in well, then I was in Montreal. And I thought, you know, if I can get this book published, I can be a full-time writer, but never got it published. So, and I think I got enough positive feedback about Murderabilia that I thought, well, you know, if this takes off, I can actually tell the world I'm a in the banking world, I write about serial killers, and that'll be the end of that. But you know, and I can be a writer. And then you know, banking just got to be such of a such a drag. And fortunately, my wife works that I just decided this is I'm not getting any younger, and this is what I need to do.
You had burned out on banking. You had done a long
Yeah,
time, and
yeah.
probably the writing was when you really want to be doing something else, the banking probably you wanted to write, and the banking probably
Yeah.
became more and more drudgery, and just wasn't feeding your soul the way
Right.
the artistic stuff is. Let me ask you
Well,
about.
and the thing is, what you're searching for is something meaningful, you know, that's meaningful to me. And, you know, the writing did that. And it's not always easy. It's a chore a lot of days, you know. But you're searching for that point where you really feel it's meaningful. And you know, when there's a scene you've written and it brings tears to your eyes, or you're just so happy, you know, because that's what's in the scene. And, you know, I didn't get that in banking.
No, you rarely, the only time you would cry is if one of your loans failed,
Or after you've been told, well, you know, maybe another bank is better for you.
Well, you're obviously resilient, Carl.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about your viewing habits. Are you
Yeah.
what are you streaming these days on Netflix or Amazon Prime or any of these or Apple TV? Do you have
Yeah.
any series the recent series or current
Yeah.
series that you've been
Well,
focusing on?
my wife and I watch things together, and I can only watch really violent things after she goes to bed. So that limits my time, right? And but you know, we watched, for instance, The Morning Show, which was
Oh, that's great.
That was great.
I watch it with my wife. I have the same wife as you do, I guess, because I can't.
Yeah.
I have to watch the violent stuff when she's not watching. She can't handle that. But the morning show, we love. That was great.
Yeah, or Hacks, you know?
Oh yeah.
Oh,
There's so few people have
hilarious.
seen that,
Oh,
but
you
that
gotta
first
see
season in
that.
particular, Jean Smart is brilliant in it, and the
Yeah.
writing's brilliant.
Yeah. And then, you know, from a more character, well, more of a literary flow is My Brilliant Friend, you know, which is based on the
Oh,
Ferrante
that's
novels.
yeah, yep. Elena Ferrante,
Yeah.
huge selling novels with her character set in Italy. Yeah. She
Yeah.
tried to remain anonymous for a long
For
time,
a long
and
time.
but she
Is
got
she
so
not
famous.
anonymous now?
No, it came out, and people were trying to track her down. That investigative reporting was done, and they found her.
Yeah.
She yeah she it just once you get that popular, people are gonna try to out you. Who is she really? And they did. She could still, hopefully she hasn't ruined her career, and she'll
Yeah.
continue to write good novels.
Yeah. Boy, but there's someone who really could get into the mind of a teenager, of a young
The minor
woman.
in yeah, and she I remember I read one or two of her novels, but and I think it was My Brilliant Friend.
Yeah.
So one where they were by then they were older, the little adults, and they spent like a whole summer at a lake in Italy, and
Yeah.
each day was the thing about her the reading at that point was pretty repetitive and boring.
Oh,
But it
really?
conveyed exactly what was happening. It's the repetitiveness of the day. Get up in the morning, they grab their towels, they go to
Yeah.
the lake, the shorefront of the lake, and that's the kind of thing that a lot of writers would just think, I can't
I
do this
can't do
because it's
that.
going to be too boring.
Yeah.
But it actually conveyed to the readers the real experience of, you're hanging out with these people,
Yeah.
you're at the lake, And this is what happens. You get into these habits, and even though it's a getaway and you have a lake there, it gets boring and it gets repetitive. And that's real life.
Well,
Now,
you
there are
know,
arguments to be made that you want to escape boredom, and when you read a
right.
novel, you don't want to be bored by it. But
No, I'm,
Elena Ferrante pulled it off, obviously.
yeah, well, I don't have the courage to try that. But,
I don't either.
and I didn't read those novels actually. I just saw the series, but I did listen to The Lying Life of My Parents or something like that. It was her
That's another
most,
Ferrante book, right?
yes.
Yeah.
And I listened to it and I thought, oh, she has so got the perception of a teenager.
She must have had teenage girls.
Maybe, I don't know. Or her teenage life was really vibrant, you know? Yeah.
So, final question, Carl. What is your state of mind while you're writing? Do you bring a certain, I mean, I don't know if you intentionally try to have a certain mindset when you sit down to write, or it's just whatever you're feeling that day.
I usually have a goal that I've seen that something I have in mind I want to work on. It could be a new scene, you know, and I'll have, you know, something maybe general in an outline. So if I'm doing a first scene, that's what I'll do. And then I got to get 5 pages. I got to get 5 pages. Or it could be in terms of revising something. Does this really work? Do the lines work? I'm constantly trying to eliminate words, you know. Where the
You
dialogue
want lean,
conveys,
fast writing, right?
yes, and I don't want to tell the reader what to think when they can see that they can hear it in the dialogue, or they can see it in the gesture, or they can feel it in the setting, you know, and you get on sidetracked and kind of eliminate all these things, and you know, some of the brilliant sentences you thought were before you have to eliminate. Because you're just telling what's already in the scene.
Yeah, you know, there was a an author and I think writing coach who said used the phrase "let the facts blaze on the page." Never mind all the ornamental stuff, you know, make it clean and lean and let the reader intuit from the situations and the facts on the ground what they need to gather. And you also trust the reader that way. Sometimes we don't trust the reader because we think, are they going to understand what I'm talking about here or what I mean here? And so we second guess ourselves, but we're also second guessing the reader. I think that it's interesting. You talk about trying to eliminate words, and I think that's a process of trusting. Sometimes it's a process of trusting the reader that they've got the, and especially people who read. Read into things as well. They will connect the dots. So we don't have to be overly explicit. In fact, I think that's deadly to writing, being overly explicit.
You're probably right. And one of the big problems is internal, right? You've got a character that has to have an internal point of view, but it's got to be different than what they're talking about, right? It's got to be as interesting as the dialogue. And it can't be too much and it can't be too little. It's got to be a balance. So that kind of trade-off is always difficult.
My guest has been Carl Vondereau, award-winning author of crime fiction. His current novels are Murderabilia. That was his first one, published in 2019. His second one out now since August of last year, Saving Miles. And Miles is spelled Myles. And he's got a third one on the way. It's in the oven. It's at 350 degrees. We don't know how long it needs to bake for, but we're
I'm
looking
hoping
forward.
another 3 weeks.
There you go. Oh, is that right? Is that your deadline? 3 more weeks?
Well, my deadline was the end of the year, but anyway.
Well, we're not far into this year. Well, Carl, thank you for coming on the program. I wish you luck with the new novel,
Thank
but really
you.
appreciate your time.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me, Mike. This was a great fun, this conversation.